So the most controversial thing we'll probably get into is I'm going to be talking about the polar ice caps, and I'm not going to have a political opinion on that. We can talk about it as part of the Q&A. If you're interested in getting my attention to stop me, ask a question, absolutely fine with that. Just keep in mind we're backed up against lunch, and I know about that. And also the keynote, so you want to get a good seat for the keynote, which is right behind us over here. So I prepped a bunch of stuff. You guys don't care about me, but you can find me on the internet. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Wikipedia. I'm on Amazon. So if you want to find me, that's great. But I think it's so cool that somebody that's not down in the deep code, somebody that doesn't hack, is not in info security, can actually get a venue like this for people like you that are interested in not just all this technical stuff, right? But you go all the way from the hacktivism side right down into the ones and zeros. And I've been coming to Hope probably about the last 10 years worth of conferences. And I don't even know if they still have this van, but you know, if you can get your picture with the 2600 van, you definitely want to do it. So welcome to New York. It's the only place in the world where you can actually get controversy over their own signs. I guess these went up and immediately people wanted them taken down, but they're out there. I lived in New York in the 90s. I lived in Brooklyn. I was stationed over at Floyd Bennett Field with the Coast Guard Air Station over there, which is now closed. I was flying this H-65 helicopter, and this was my hangar. It's now run by the New York Police Department. They actually have their air sea rescue out there. Giuliani was the mayor. The squeegee guys were on their way out. These guys were on the way up, did a good job that year, a couple years in a row. This was the telephone company, right? Who has ever had a bill from these people, right? I see a few hands, good. Cell phones were analog. This was my cell phone. This was my computer. This is my internet, right? So dial-up, you know that little beep-de-nee sound? There you go. This is how most people got on the internet. You had competing floppy disks that came in the mail. And you could use them for doorstops. You can use them any way that you can think of. And if you were in New York, you probably had Panix as your internet service provider if you were in the scene at all. If you're not an AOL or CompuServe person, and I went and looked, they're still around. Actually, number three. So this was the big battle at the time, NSCA, Mosaic, and Netscape. And Netscape was on the up and up because they supported one tag that nobody else supported. Everybody's favorite tag, right? So I'm just giving you some historical or a little bit of context of where I come from. Because we had blogs, but no, we didn't. There were no such thing as blogs, right? What did we have? HTML 1.0. You had to get down in the code. I started doing this stuff in 94. I got my own website in 95. This was like with the first 100,000 websites. And I went to the Wayback Machine, and this is as far as they went, was 97. And I was interested in a couple things, actually. I was getting married, and my brother's band needed a web page. And somebody could email me, so. This was my first computer. It's my first experience, right? Yeah, okay, going all the way back. And this was our disk drive, right? So about a 300 baud going through there, right? So you got really good with this economy of bits. The idea that you've got to streamline the pipe. So this brings me to when I was getting ready to go down south. Polar Operations Coast Guard flew the H-65 helicopter based out of Mobile, but we got on the icebreakers and we went to the poles. So the Wayback Machine pulled this for 2000. This is what my website looked like at the time. And I went three times to the Arctic. These are all still up, and they're kind of embarrassing now when you look back, but they were hand-coded and uploaded using Dreamweaver and whatever we had at the time. You can go check this out if you want. Resonate.com/polar. And there's a fourth one on there. This is the South trip. So I thought between these sites, and let it run through again, and this site, wouldn't it be great if I could up my game just a little bit? So this is the site that's up there now for the deep freeze. And I realized that I was going to have a problem because I was going where I had never been before. And I was trying to get internet where there's never been internet before. Antarctica. Right? So here's my problem. I've got to get bits from Antarctica up to the internet so that I can have a basically equivalent of a web blog. This is my platform. This is where we were going out of. Coast Guard Cutter, Polar Sea. Right? So anybody out here worked science, worked on icebreakers before? I don't see anybody, but if you ever get a chance to go to a polar region, you should do it. If you can get a job and they can pay you to go there, that's even better. They talk about Antarctica as, you know, the first time you go for the adventure. The second time, you go for the money. The third time, you go because you realize there's nowhere else in the world that you belong. And it really is one of those cool, special places in the world. All right, so I realized I had three problems as I was going down there: signal, access, and content. Talk a little bit about signal first. This is a relay satellite. There's different bands out there. I'm not going to get into the techniques of technical stuff about the frequencies and that type of thing. This is going to be fairly high level because I'm an operator as opposed to a technician. I've got a little engineer experience, but I'm more of an operator. But basically, if you're going to send anything from where you are through a satellite, it's going to go up on one channel, come back on another channel, from the sending through to the receiving station, right? Here's some different frequencies they can use. Voice a lot of times goes on the P band. When I was down there, we were using the C band, which is what's depicted on the left there. And a lot of stuff today now goes out on the K band. So you got above and under, so above and under bands. So you hear a lot about the geosynchronous satellite in a geosynchronous orbit. And when they say geosynchronous, it may not necessarily be what you think it is, because something can be synchronous and still not be right around that geographic or that celestial equator. So it traces this kind of funky little figure eight through the sky. What you're looking for is a geostationary orbit. And if I use my globe over here, I'm gonna have to put the microphone down for a sec. That's about what you're looking at, right? So the satellite is going to be going around like this. Somebody can get that later. Okay, so geostationary orbit, you've got your satellite that's out there, and it stays over a spot on planet Earth, and it never really moves, right? So to get coverage of the entire planet, you typically need a constellation of a minimum of three satellites. And this is a terrible picture because the satellites, as we just saw, are not that close to planet Earth to be geostationary. There's only one spot, one altitude that they can be. This is a little bit better geometry. And what you see here, that constellation of three satellites separated by 120 degrees of longitude, blanketing the Earth, hopefully with signal. But there's a problem. This angle of elevation is great when you're looking at a satellite that's basically up at the zenith or down towards the horizon. But when you get close to the pole, look what happens. You draw this tangent from where that satellite is, the line of sight, right? And you're standing on the surface of the Earth, and you're looking out at the satellite at 0 degrees. There's going to be this little angle that if you trace that around, there's a dead zone. No matter what you do, you will never see that satellite if you're inside this little circle. You're inside 81 degrees latitude, above or below. You're not going to see it because it's below the horizon. Well, this is where I was going, 77. So let's take a look. There's the no-go zone. This is where I'm going. I'm good to go. Right? So 77 to 81 is 4-degree difference. So there's a satellite that tracks the horizon, and it's sitting there waiting for me to send it data 4 degrees above the horizon. You do not simply send data to the satellite, because guess what? Sending up through the atmosphere, you've got minimum attenuation. It's like on a foggy day. You look up, you can see the sky, but you can't see anything out to the side. And this is some of the problem, too, this atmospheric attenuation. And there's a cool little graph that helps with this. Right, so if you're looking straight up, you're usually pretty good. But where I was at 4 degrees, I start to get into this really bad zone where it starts to absorb the signal. So I had to consider that. But I was still pretty good right about 4 degrees. Anything less or higher, lower, would have been bad. So now there's access, because guess what? When you're on the ship, there's always going to be an IT guy, right? They're going to be out there, and they're going to be wanting to be in charge. This was my IT guy. I mean, he was a dead ringer for this guy, right? When I first started going out to the ships, this was really our only way to get personal information back ashore, right? Any Mars operators out there, thank you very much for what you do. Unfortunately, this logo does not have Coast Guard in there, but I operated a Mars station out of Brooklyn before they shut the air station down about 20 years ago. But when I was getting on the ships, they were just starting to get personal email, right? First of all, we had one email for the whole ship, and all 100 guys had to write emails through that same system. The guy would print the emails out and then distribute them, so if you had something private from your spouse, no one else would read it except for the radio guy. And do we have attachments? No attachments, right? So we had to do everything with text. Thankfully, I was using Eudora, which used, there it is, right? Go Eudora. And it had UUN code built in. There were different ways to take that, but basically you would take an attachment, you would convert it into textual characters like this, and then your email program would pop it out the other side. And I think my wife is watching the stream, so thank you very much for being my minion, because these attachments would come through and then she would upload them for me if I couldn't do it. Of course, after a while, you know, you make sure that you don't want to have your minions upset at you. So I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could just FTP all this stuff myself, right? Nope. It wasn't that it couldn't do the FTP, it was that the port was blocked. So remember my guy, my IT guy, right? Keep your IT guys happy. Because this guy was telling me this until I figured out what his red stapler was. This guy had a whole stack of 100-something laser discs, right? This is pre-DVD. It's the same thing, but they're giant. Well, his laser disc player broke. I found out about that, called back home. They shipped us a laser disc player. We plugged it back in, and this guy was my best friend. And guess what? FTP worked great. Yeah. So this is one of those words that's fraught with danger, because back in the day, if you said you were the webmaster, that actually carried some weight. If you say webmaster today, people kind of look at you like dungeon master, webmaster, I have no idea what you're talking about. But if you were the webmaster, back then you had some skills. Here's one other thing we had to worry about, is because the satellite time was tasked by the government, we had these blackout sectors where we were not allowed to broadcast. Some of it was money, some of it was other ships, so it was coverage for the Pacific Theater and going south. But we did have these little shifting two-hour windows where we could actually put stuff out there and do the uploads. So as you know, middle of the night's the best time to do that. A couple nights they shifted the clocks and I forgot, so I was up at 1 o'clock for the 1 to 3 window, and it was actually 12 o'clock, and I only had an hour left, or it was an hour early, and I'm sitting there waiting for the internet to come up. But I was able to put this out there. So this is available still. If you want to go to resonate.com/polar, this is the Deep Freeze 02 page. And we're going to talk a little bit now about once I got in theater. So broadcasting from the ship coming down through the equator was great. We fly off into McMurdo Station. This is an aerial of McMurdo. This is where the helicopters operate down there. This is my dorm rooms over here. This is where you eat. This is the Carrere Lab, which is where all the scientists do their work. About 1,000 people here during the Austral summer. 100 of them are scientists, and the rest are support folks from firefighters, medical personnel, all the engineers, construction, and then all the technical people that support the science. It's really pretty amazing operation. We used to say that you could tell someone's IQ as an inverse proportion to how well they were dressed. So if you saw a guy walking down the street with his shirt fixed with duct tape, it was probably a genius. And I don't have the sign. I should have dug it out, but there was an IQ 15 sign right in the main street. IQ limit. All right, so to get from that station, let me go back. Big operation, right? They had data coming through, and they were doing science ops. So this was Black Island. It was 28 miles away, fully DC powered, so you got solar, you got wind, and they did have a diesel backup generator if they needed it, but pretty much all their electricity was done from right on site. And they had the microwave relay. You just see just how large these domes are to protect the satellite dishes. Again, we're 4 degrees from cutoff, right? So they're tracking satellites that are 4 degrees above the horizon. And we had pretty good access. So the last thing, of course, is content. Now, this is a technical thanks to N0NHJ for the write-up, but this is some of the technical capability of Black Island Relay Site for Antarctica. And this is pretty much what we had, right? So for the entire base, 1,000 scientists, all the science op, plus all our little fun stuff like sending text messages and emails home. Well, that's tiny. You look at download speeds, you know, it's maybe 3 times faster than an ISDN line. But if you look at cell phone, if you have a 3G connection, you have 3 times as much bandwidth as the entire continent of Antarctica had 10 years ago, right? Every single person in this room, of course, has at least that amount. Pretty amazing. So you got to make these things tiny if you're going to get media out, right? And what I found on this website is most of the time, we were pretty good with 320 by 240. I would do some upsample, and you can show some stuff this way, and my camera was limited to 2 megapixel. This is the technology back in the day. 2 megapixel will get you a pretty nice looking print. But it's also 10 times bigger, trying to squeeze it through the pipe. So here's a lesson learned, right? Respect the signal, because there's scientists doing this stuff, and you don't want to have some government guy come sniffing around saying, "What are you doing with my satellite signal?" When you throw out official business, be careful, because you might get this response, right? Someone is always watching. If you're working on a government installation, absolutely. So I found a way to go make some of what I was doing official business. I put up these really cool press release photos, and I sent it to my guys at headquarters. And they turned around, and they sent it to everybody from the White House on down. And they loved it, and they wrote us back, and they say, anything this guy needs as far as bandwidth, make it happen, because he's sending us these really cool pictures. This particular picture in general, or in specific, rather, I've seen this thing attributed to anybody from myself, to any number of PAs, to folks from the BBC. It was actually done by a guy at CNN, John Booth, so that's his picture. So as I said, there's stuff up here. Now, I did a few other little things, too, like these little pages here about individual photos, different types of things. It's interesting when you start putting content up there that you get feedback from completely unexpected sources. My wife's uncle and all his buddies love this McMurdo machinery, right? So this is all the half tracks. This is the giant buses. This is all the aircraft. And so they said, we want more of that stuff. So I made them a special page. I also did a couple panoramas, a QuickTime VR just to test it out. These tiny little movies, though, right? So this is my chance to get a glass of water. I'm going to show you a really short video of some penguins. I get a sip of water, and if there's any questions about my first trip doing satellite from deep ocean. The comment was, or question was, were we shooting this from the helicopter? That was actually done from the bridge wing of the ship. So looking down as the penguin was coming through the lead between the ship and the ice. Want to watch it again? All right, so the penguins, they flock just like any group of birds, right? They're birds, they flock together. And they know instinctually that something is waiting to eat them. And so they wait for the first one to go, and after the first one goes, they figure he's been eaten so the rest of us can go. And this is where they say if penguins don't fly, but they actually do fly, they just happen to fly in a different fluid medium, which is the water. And they're really graceful until they get on land. And then they just look absolutely absurd. So, okay, so my second trip, and I think we're tracking okay for time here. I did this trip around the world with my wife after I retired. And we decided, because she had cancer, we could talk a little bit more about that offline, that it was time to move up some of our dreams, and so we plotted this trip around the world. We found a ship that would take us, and we went on this trip here. And we said, if we're going to do a trip of a lifetime, let's blog about it, of course, right? You got to get to the ship, and then maybe we'll turn it into a book. In order to do this, you need satellite internet, so I took a look at the price. And I was not happy because it's 25 cents a minute. That's the cheapest plan. All right, so you do the math. I'm going to need to come up with $1,500. So I didn't have $1,500 after I paid for getting on a ship to go around the world. We decided we were still going to do it anyway, so we went up on Kickstarter. It's based right out here in Brooklyn. Anybody ever done a Kickstarter? Okay, a couple Kickstarters in the room. Fantastic platform for creative projects, but it has to be a creative project. So we did it as a book. We put it up there with a goal of 3,000. We got funded by 153 people. So we were good to go. So if you look at that yellow line, that's between 37 degrees south and 62 degrees north. So we're good as far as geosynchronous satellites. Don't have to worry about high latitude stuff. But I still had the same three considerations. So first of all, with the signal, if you look back to the icebreaker, right, and you notice some of these little antennas here, they're pointing right at the satellite and they're paired up. They do these things in pairs because of the superstructure when you get to those very extreme latitudes. So one of those is going to be masked by the mast, the stack, right? But the other one is still going to be able to see past it. So even if this one's looking at metal, the other one's going to be fine. And there they are. This is down in the P-band. That's a voice SATCOM. But we're looking at C-band and K-band now. Here's a picture we took going into Athens on our trip around the world. These things are massive, massive satellite dishes that are in there. I also like having a nice high-quality camera because then you can see that there's a guy back there surfing his iPad. That was on the Windstar. They're based out of Nassau. And just real quick, you know, technology. So we've come so far ahead to go so far behind with the sales and everything. It's pretty amazing. Traveling around the world, you see some really cool technology. And then, of course, with the K-band, you can have a much smaller antenna. And so here's a yacht we saw anchored out of Monte Carlo. If you look up the number on the helicopter and the name of the yacht, it's an interesting exercise. So if you want to do that, November 145, looks like Sierra Alpha, and then Sunrays. But check that out. So if you take a look, they've got a whole lot of comms. A little hard to see in this picture. But they've got paired satellite dishes here. They've got a pair here. They've got a single here, another single here. So they're always going to be in contact. So we talk about the plane of the ecliptic, right? That's where all the planets orbit, Earth orbits. But then you also have this celestial equator. Celestial equator is where you're going to see all your geosynchronous satellites. This is about a year old, but it's about the same. They don't change much. About 275 satellites are up right now. And if you look, this being the prime meridian, so this is over the UK, right? Coming around North America. This is going to be up over India. And then you come around all the way through Asia, and then this empty spot is the Pacific. So there's not much going on out there. Now, we talked about three satellites make the constellation, right? And hopefully you can see that. This is the area that a... Yep.
In the light, otherwise the UV doesn't see you.
You got it. Okay. So you got three satellites minimum in order to blanket most of the planet. I wish I had a better diagram here because this shows, this is actually a three axis. If you look at it with a Z axis also, those three lines. But there's another way to look at it thanks to Inmarsat. Right over the satellite, you're going to have great coverage. And as you get out to the edges, as you would imagine, right? So as your angle of elevation decreases, you're going to lose some signal, which is why they have the overlap areas. And as we were cruising around the world, we had a four-satellite constellation with Inmarsat 3. And when this came into play, when this satellite went down, and I was in this area, and I had no internet basically from... the Arabian Gulf all the way through the Red Sea, because the fringe from the green satellite wasn't getting it done and the blue satellite was down. So there was my signal. Access from these ships, you sign in, and there's the fine print, of course, with everything you do. They have to point out that internet access from ships is significantly slower. I mean, folks in this room have no problem understanding that, but some people do. And then they actually do some port blocking. So we had no YouTube, we had no Facebook videos, but they were actually fairly generous with what they allowed up on there. There was a time when my website was blocked, and I'll talk about that here in a minute. So halfway into the trip, I was almost halfway through our 6,000 minutes that we had budgeted for and purchased. I was picking up the 1,000-minute plans one at a time. So at this point, we already burned through $500 worth of internet time, and we were well on our way to that third block. This was my IT guy. He was from Romania, and no, this is an actor, Boris, but he looked like this guy. And as I was starting to burn through some of these internet minutes where the satellite wasn't there and we had no bandwidth and I kept logging on and I couldn't get anything through, it's amazing what you can do if you keep your IT guy happy. So I had no problem with bandwidth after a while. Okay, who knows what this is? Traffic graph, 24 hours, right? So if you're a web person, you're tracking this stuff. This is when I would get up to try to send my traffic. The interesting thing with the graph on the ship is that there was actually a little spike right about here, because this is when the crew got off work, and they would stay up and they'd get on there and they'd do the stuff they needed to do. So that was a signal. So content, I picked WordPress. I'm a Drupal person. I like the content management systems. The benefit here is that you put all your traffic on the server. So anything you can move server side, you can move LAN side. Just like back in the day, I had my wife. She was my minion. She was my LAN side connection. By doing it in a CMS now is much, much easier. There's some advantages that I see to using a CMS, specifically WordPress. Great feature. Because you don't have to be online to compose an email. You jump online, you hit send, your email goes to WordPress, and all your media, all your writing, your blog goes right up there, and then you can log off and save some minutes. There's also the ability to schedule posts. I pre-schedule the post every day for 105 days around the world, so that even if I was out of coverage, my 153 backers plus everybody following the blog would be able to get a post for that day. And then the other nice thing is that it automates sending it to all the other social media platforms. So one email or a scheduled post would go out on our entire bank of platforms. Some of the downsides, of course, is buffering issues, right? So you're trying to do something through a web portal over a satellite internet that has at least a quarter millisecond delay, or quarter second delay, 250 millisecond delay. Theming issues, sometimes the CSS doesn't keep up with what the browsers are doing. Or there's a latency issue and it's not going to come through. You're going to miss elements of your theme. And then, yeah, there were a few things where the site was blocked for whatever reason. Also, some people didn't like my web host, so that got blacklisted for whatever reason. Typically, 1 megapixel was enough to keep all the backers happy. Of course, we had much better. And then I had my back-end minions. Those are my brothers. So they were doing all the stuff that when I couldn't do it and the schedule went, posts went down and it wasn't working, those guys would do it. So how many minutes did we actually use? Left about an hour on the table. But we pretty much used everything we had budgeted for, and this is it. So on the page today, I've got a little post up for the 11th Hope, but you can check this out, westbysea.com. And I'm actually reposting all the blog posts in order all summer long. So, 3 years ago, today, we were somewhere on the approach to New York Harbor. We actually got the book done. It's out in a couple different formats. There's a treasure hunt one, which is codes and ciphers, and you can find a lat long. It's like a giant geocache. And then this is just the story of the trip on the right there. So what's the future look like for deep ocean internet? Somebody's concept, but it's not really that crazy because these floating lily pads are going to need to have connectivity, and you're not going to string cables, and you're probably not going to set up a microwave relay way out in the middle of the ocean. So they're going to have to come up with ways to try to get signal back and forth to either that or the increased vessel traffic. Here's where we talk about the polar ice caps, right? Coast Guard position on it is this. We don't care about the politics. If there's water and there's coastline, we've got to protect it, right? So save people that might happen to be there, protect the environment if there's an oil spill or a disaster, protect the living marine resources, whatever those, the mammals and the fisheries, all going to be up there, right? So if there's no ice on the poles, if there's water there, this is a concern because about a third of that area has got no coverage from geosynchronous satellites. So how are we going to do this? There's a lot of commercial solutions that are out there that are taking those big C-band into the Ku band and then all the way down to these tiny little dishes. This is an all-in-one solution. I don't work for them. I have no affiliation with them, and they've not paid me anything. It's just a solution that's out there. But you can find a bunch, just a quick web search. A little hard to see this one, but these guys actually do tours up in Svalbard, and they're doing a hybrid satellite and terrestrial cellular set, basically. It just, wherever you happen to be, it picks up the most fast connection, and it switches that over. So for the user, it's seamless. You just have a Wi-Fi connection. If you happen to be close to land, the system switches over, and now you've got terrestrial internet again. So it's another way to do that. And then, of course, Iridium, the original 77 satellites. From what I understand, they're down to 66. So six planes, each with 11 satellites in it, constantly moving. The circumpolar is really one of the better ways to get that. But because of the nature of the things constantly moving and your terrestrial antenna has to keep tracking that, it makes it kind of difficult just to keep the track going. All right, so what do we learn, right? You can't stop the signal, but to get the signal out, you have to think like the signal. There's a redundancy involved. So if you're going to go over the horizon and you're going to do this type of expeditionary data transmission, data blogging, it's good to have a backup plan. So we went with two laptops, seven cameras. I went with a Drobo, which had plenty of storage space and redundancy there. Did backups to a secondary hard drive. You got to have all kinds of fail safes. And then, of course, you've got the fail safe on the other end. If your server goes down, possibly have a second domain, you can switch everything over if it's mirrored. I didn't go that far because I trusted my domain, but you know, that's a calculated risk. Plan for the lowest common denominator, so that's over here, right? So the lowest common denominator is still kind of text-based, right? Back in the days of TTY, back in the 80s and 90s, you still see a lot of text-based stuff. So if you think like that and get lucky, you might be able to send some additional media. But think about that lowest common denominator. And it's not necessarily your own gear either. It might also be people's gear at the other end. Less of a problem today because fairly good web standards, fairly good browsers that are out there, so you stand a good chance of being able to get your information out. But if you're relying on Facebook or Twitter, you might want to rethink that. And then the last piece, of course, is respect the bandwidth, because you don't want to have that Agent Smith looking over your shoulder going, why are you filling my pipeline with all kinds of other goodies? And the last thing is respect your minions, because they will take care of you. Right, so I want to thank the folks here at HOPE and all the media folks, the tech folks, who put this all together so we could all have a fantastic conference. Now, I do have some other tech from around the world, but that's pretty much the meat of the talk. So like I said, lunch is coming up. You want to get a seat for the keynote, please, by all means, go ahead and take off. Thank you for listening, and any questions you got, I'll take them now. Thanks.
Did you consider amateur radio solutions for communicating over the horizon?
The comment was asked about amateur radio solutions. I thought about it. I'm a ham, KC2GRD, but for the applications that I had and the time frame that I had to put that together, I didn't do that. Do you have a couple suggestions maybe, or is it just a solution that you would have suggested?
Various digital modes at various speeds, depending on how much you want to spend on the equipment, essentially.
Gotcha.
I just don't know how well they work in the polar regions, propagation-wise. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on it.
Yeah, I will say from South Pole, they do a lot of stuff shortwave out of there because they relay. It's at 800 miles from the pole into the nearest larger base, which is McMurdo. And so they do have different ways that they can relay stuff that way, but it's very slow. And of course, they've got a lot more money than I do, so they can do it. So, okay, so another hand. Go ahead, sir.
So you mentioned using ship traffic to send signals in the future from the floating city. So how would you actually do that? Is it like a delay tolerant networking sort of solution? What's the idea there?
The comment was using ship traffic to try to get signal to a floating city. I would think that one possible solution would be you could have a series of relays that would go ship to ship to ship. So there are some technical hurdles that would be involved with that, similar to what you'd have with terrestrial relays that they already have. In addition to that, because those floating platforms move, you're also going to have some kind of a stabilized system or gyroscope system that would keep those antennas pointed in the right direction. So I'll go here and then here.
I know that there's been some exploration of kind of unmanned ships, unmanned small boats. So is there a solution in the pipeline? Because those definitely need consistent, reliable uplinks.
Yeah, we're talking about unmanned ships or floating platforms that are out there, and I haven't done any research on that. I would imagine that there's probably some folks out there, but it's also back to who can you get somebody to pay for it, right? So is there a viable financial interest in that beyond just an altruistic need behind that? Hey, this would be a great idea. We'd love to do it. But if you can figure out how to monetize something like that and then field it practically, they may be the path to your door.
A lot of those pedal cities going to be located in the mid-latitudes, so you really don't have a communication problem. You could use the existing satellites or O3b solution, which provides multi-megabit service at very low latency with medium Earth orbit satellites.
Yeah, so the comment was where you're going to put these floating habitats or floating platforms for whatever reason, you actually are situated geographically in a very good area to be able to provide some high bandwidth to those platforms. So it's a great point. Anybody else? All right, if you want to stick around, I'll go through a couple of cool photos, tech from around the world here. So we went to Singapore. And this is a novelty to me, they actually be able to see how far away the subway is, which I guess now they're putting in New York, so thank goodness, thank you, New York, for putting that in. Wow, super clean, right? Singapore used to be that if you spit gum on the ground, you could be arrested and thrown in jail. They don't actually sell gum in the entire country of Singapore. So they've relaxed that a little bit. You can actually bring gum in. But, you don't want to be seen chewing gum over in Singapore. And look at that. Beautiful, beautiful. People going to work, using their tech. Parking spaces. As you drive down the street, because it's such a tiny area and there are so many cars, you don't know where to park, and you don't know if when you show up somewhere you're going to have a space. Every single parking space in all these buildings or parking garages has a little way to track if it's open or occupied. And these are broadcast right along the street. So as you're driving around, we saw this also in Kuala Lumpur. Pretty amazing. Wouldn't it be cool if we had that type of thing here? I thought this was interesting just because there's a lot of different ways to get money. This is in Malaysia. But they had a vacancy, and it had to be a female. So you can never do that. But there it was. Sort of interesting. This is in India. I don't know if I would actually go and patronize this business. Thought it was interesting. So this is a fun picture, right? So typical settlement in Mumbai. And there's a lot of blue tarps there, and it's very impoverished. But I also noticed in this picture quite a number of satellite dishes. So, the signal wants to get out there. And you prioritize your spending, so is it TV or is it a new roof for your house? This is at the Taj Mahal. I'm sorry, go ahead.
The speaker went over satellite access, and in many countries in East Asia, it's free to air, and it's like their only TV.
Uh-huh. Okay, so the comment was in certain countries, free to air over the satellite dish is one way they can get their signal. Excellent point. So these beautiful historical places still have a lot of tech. This is a weather station. Just took a picture of that. It's kind of interesting. This is, as you're walking around, you're going to notice some things. Typical Indian telephone pole. My understanding is that the electricians pass down what wires go where from father to son, so it's a family-run business. And you get this as your inheritance. Here's another one. These aren't even the worst examples. I just didn't take pictures of them. This is on a train from India to New Delhi, or excuse me, from Mumbai to New Delhi. Universal plug, probably 240 because you've got the switch. Wi-Fi zone for foreign tourists. Use at your own risk. thought this was kind of cool. This was in Langkawi, a little hardware store. If you don't know what your light bulb goes to or what to buy a replacement light bulb with, you can come to this little board, plug your light bulb in until you find the right information, and then you pull the right one off the shelf. This is a telephone in Dubai at the airport. Fairly standard, cool hush hoods. Also in Dubai is this basically a hologram. It's not really a hologram, but it would address you in whatever language you would address it. So it was actually pretty cool because it would tailor the delivery based on the needs of the user. Kind of lost in translation, maybe. You know, I think I'd buy something from this guy, maybe not that guy. This was in Jordan, pretty cool, mega complex of electronics. You can go buy Sharp. This is the Avenue of the Sphinxes right outside the Temple of Luxor. It's a very beautiful place until you start looking around and you realize that everybody's got to sell over there, right? So as you've heard, in less developed areas of the world, they've leapfrogged those terrestrial landlines and they've gone right to wireless. Huge market. Internet Wi-Fi at the Lost City of Petra. So this is pretty cool. This is a holy site in Athens. And I sort of thought this was interesting because in ancient times, people go to the highest spot because they thought that would bring them closer to the gods. It was a very powerful place of geography. And it's the same today, except now with all the antennas. So these high points on the planet are still valuable, but for a different reason. This is in Istanbul, just American audio, kind of interesting, electronics shop, and giant speaker out front so people know to come in because they're playing some cool music. This is in Cadiz in Spain, and I just thought it was neat because when you're doing an electrical tower, yeah, you can build an electrical tower, but why not make it beautiful, right? So it's that just noticeable difference. As you build things, it's okay to do a kludge, throw it together with some duct tape and make it work, but eventually, you know, that form does matter. This is in Le Havre in France, just a kind of a cool little car. It's a one-person vehicle, completely enclosed, easy to park. Is it two?
One person sits behind the
other. Okay, so it's a tandem? Yeah.
It's not really comfortable.
Yeah. So we have some people that have experience with this. I have no experience with this, but I thought it was cool. So that's why you come to Hope, because we get to hang out with people from all around the world who know things we don't. This is in Amsterdam, and they love the wind over there. So this ducted fan energy generation is kind of cool. Also coming out of, this is actually coming out of Rotterdam, and this is a giant swinging door to block waves out of the North Sea if the waves get too bad, so you don't end up with the stuff coming in. Huge engineering undertaking to have two wing doors, one from the left, one from the right, and this hinge here, you know, being able to keep the ocean back. This is in New Zealand. We use RFID to tag on and off, you know, so this is actually a ferry that would go inner city in Auckland. Hey, there we were on the ship, right? It was just to see just how humongous these things are. And then we pulled into New York. You got to show a New York telephone booth. So they're still out there. Then I got a bunch of pictures from around the world. So that's pretty much it. But cool tech. Still got about 5 minutes to go.